Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network. Visit newbooksnetwork.com for more podcast interviews with authors working in a range of subjects. This podcast comes to you in affiliation with the North American Society for Sport History, promoting the academic study and research of sport around the world. Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. We had our first snowfall in my neighborhood this past weekend. So as an antidote against the looming cold and gray of winter, we look this week at that most summery of sports, surfing. My guests are historians Peter Westwick and Peter Neuschel. Both are natives of Santa Barbara, California, and lifelong surfers. Since 2008, they have taught a popular course at UC Santa Barbara on the history of the sport. But far more than an account of the sport's great figures or its influence on popular culture, Peter and Peter's course use surfing as a window to examine the changing environment of the world's beaches and the ways in which technological innovations have impacted the sport. Their teaching and subsequent research resulted in the book The World in the Curl, An Unconventional History of Surfing, published in 2013 by Crown. This is a wide-reaching work of sports history. The book looks at the colorful figures in the history of surfing and surfing culture from Hawaii to Southern California and Australia. But it also looks at the broad array of developments that have been integral to the sport, from the ways that military research led to the invention of today's surfboards and wetsuits, to the role of surfers in launching the drug trade into California, down to the ways that property developers have altered the world's great surfing beaches and even the waves that come into those beaches. If you've ever paddled into the waves on a board, or if you have interest in the history of the environment, science and technology, or post-war youth culture, you will enjoy Peter and Peter's book. Here is our interview. Peter Westwick, welcome to New Books in Sports.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
And Peter Neuschel, welcome to New Books in Sports.
Thank you for having us.
So thank you, gentlemen, both for coming on the podcast. And I'll ask you both to first say a few words about yourselves. You're both historians. You're both surfers. So can you tell us a bit more about your backgrounds in both of these areas and what led you to put these interests together?
Well, we both come from the same academic field, history of science, and we met first through that kind of academic world through conferences, and we actually both had a postdoc at Caltech. Peter was at Caltech a few years before me in the same postdoc. So we kind of knew each other through history of science, and I found out that Peter's from Santa Barbara, and I was from Santa Barbara also, so we had this shared background. And I found out that Peter Neuschel had a Boston Whaler, which is a great boat to get you up to Hollister Ranch, which is this place that you can really only surf, get access to by boat to the surf spots. So we started surfing up there together and then started talking about our mutual interests, and that eventually led to the book.
I should add, we both grew up in Santa Barbara. I'm a little older than Peter. I think I'm the same age as his older sister. And I live a little to the north of him in Goleta, and he lives in Santa Barbara. And when we looked at we have a chapter on localism in the book where we look at, you know, how surfers kind of glom on to certain areas that they surf in. It was very odd because he surfs in certain places down in Santa Barbara, and I surf in places out in Goleta. So we have a kind of a cultural split just in within our own town that kind of came up.
Peter, you mentioned your section on localism, and in that section you have an anecdote. It's seemingly kind of an
hypothetical story about a surfer driving along the coast, sees this great area, no one's there. He goes out, he paddles out, rides a few waves, and then some of the locals come out and make it clear that that he should get out of there. And I took it that that was something that perhaps both of you, one of you, has experienced directly.
Yes, I think a lot of surfers have had that experience. You know, you arrive at a break that you don't normally surf. It may be in a country you've never surfed in before, and you don't really know the culture of that break. And our book is, as you mentioned earlier, it's a world history. And so we looked in particular, for example, at Australia. We looked at this documentary on Maroubra and the Bra Boys. And we actually have a colleague who lives in Maroubra. And I went to Maroubra, went surfing in Maroubra, did research in the library at Maroubra, tried to understand, you know, what looked like a real spike in localism in Australia. But yeah, that is definitely a part of the culture of surfing that certainly someone that's new to it will experience, and it can be quite upsetting. You know, you see, say you go to Lunada Bay and you go, that's a fantastic wave. I'm going to go down there and catch some of those waves. You arrive, you go out, you're threatened by people, and which ruins your experience, even though they're not catching the waves. And then you maybe hike back up and your tires are flat. So that can be part of an unpleasant, darker side to the culture of surfing. And I think we address that fairly well in that chapter, at least half of the chapter. We look at travel and we look at localism at the same time.
One of the things we like to do in that chapter, and actually throughout the book, is kind of play with the image of surfing. I mean, the reason we focus on localism is it really kind of runs counter to a lot of the public image of surfing as, oh, it's just this bunch of laid back people. Yeah. They're hanging out on the beach. It's all super casual and groovy. But then you have these, media images of surfers beating each other up on the beach, which is not exactly the image of these casual laid back guys just hanging out and having fun. So, and that's one of the reasons why the media loves to seize on these images of surfing and surfing gangs and this kind of overblown media coverage sometimes, because it runs so counter to the public image. So that's one of the things we try to get at, is these kind of almost contradictory public images that the public receives about surfers and surf culture.
So to move from localism to the more global scope, you make the case at the book's beginning and also at the end for the importance of surfing in world sport, and thus the importance of a history of world surfing. So can you give us a sense to start of the popularity and the scope of surfing today?
Well, the statistics on it are a little bit fuzzy, and we kind of arrived at a happy medium between there's several extremes out there, ranging from 5 million surfers worldwide to 35 or 40 million. We kind of arrived at a ballpark number of around 20 million surfers worldwide, which is a pretty substantial population of surfers. And it's really spread from, you know, we go into quite a bit of detail about how surfing originated in Hawaii, or modern surfing at least, came out of Hawaii, but then spread very quickly to California, Australia, South Africa, and now there's thriving surf communities and surf culture all over the world. In some, you know, places like Japan, Brazil, but also the Mediterranean coast, Israel, Bulgaria, Iceland, Ireland, Great Britain. So some places you might not really expect to find surf communities, Morocco. So it's really become a global sport. It's a global industry. It's, I think, about a $10 billion industry now, billion with a B. And there are billion-dollar corporations like Quiksilver and Billabong. Basically multinational corporations with divisions in Europe, South America, Africa, Australia, East Asia, all over the landscape. So it's really become a global sport and a global kind of commercial phenomenon, certainly a global cultural phenomenon, because you see ads for surfing all over the landscape, whether you're at Times Square or Paris and Berlin.
Well, let's get into the book. You begin the book in Hawaii, and you point out that you know, there are probably people who are riding waves throughout the world in different cultures, but you make the case that Hawaii is the starting point of modern surfing. And you do look back at the history of Hawaii before their encounter with the English and Americans, and you describe surfing as a major part of indigenous Hawaiian culture. So can you talk about that, please?
You're right. There are, as historians like to do, everyone's always looking for another example of surfing somewhere else, whether it's in Latin America, riding a canoe and surfing waves, or you know, looking at various art depictions by artists of people riding surfboards elsewhere other than Hawaii. But we we believe that not only is Hawaii the, you know, sort of the cradle of what surfing is today, stand-up surfing, but we focus in particular on Waikiki and the history of Waikiki as sort of a, you know, today, then, forever, assuming global warming doesn't wipe out the reefs, that that will be the cradle of surfing. And if you, we spend a lot of time, we go back to Waikiki numerous times in the chapter, or in the various chapters, because that, if you look at the history of Waikiki, you can kind of understand why it is that the Hawaiians were able to have the time, the leisure time, and the physical ability, because this required a huge amount of athleticism. I know we're focusing on sport. I mean, these are some of the, one of the most magnificent aquatic peoples in the history of the world. But if you look at the history of Waikiki, you arrive there, you go surfing there today, there's a Malawai Canal that's behind all of the hotels. And that has gathered all the water that used to run down. There were three major streams that would run through Waikiki. And those in the past, now they're channeled out into the ocean. But in the past, those fed a vast wetland. And that wetland was a source of food for Hawaiians because they farmed fish in that wetland. And this is, of course, a major source of protein. And so one asks, how is it that an indigenous people are able to have the leisure time, the ability to, when the, you know, the flag goes up at the at the temple on Diamond Head that says that the the waves are big and it's time to go surfing? How is it that you're able to do that if you're scrabbling to basically feed oneself? And the Hawaiians had food on the hoof in these fish farms, literally, that were at one time at Waikiki, and were able to you know, go out and surf. Now they're also an ocean going people that are very familiar with the aquatic environment. And we looked in particular at some of the games that they would play, games such as charging out into the water and having a battle, and the person who's able to physically remove themselves from that and get back onto the beach wins, or, you know, holding your breath. How long can you hold your breath? These are people that were amazing athletes in the water. And you look at the size of some of the boards that they rode and the weight of those boards, and you picture yourself paddling those out through some heavy shore pound. That required a huge amount of physical strength. So these are people who have an economy that will sustain leisure, that have protein available, that have a culture of familiarity with the ocean that is so evident in song and in their history. So we try to bring that out, but we focus a lot on Waikiki, because that, when one arrives in Hawaii, is usually when you land in Oahu. That's the first place you're going to go. That's where the major hotels are. And to this day, that's where there are fabulous waves.
And you talk about Hawaii as well as really ideally situated in terms of geography within the Pacific Ocean to be the cradle of surfing.
Yeah, you're basically looking at islands that are exposed to every major swell that comes through. And in Hawaii, for example, if you go in the summer, chances are, hopefully, you're going to, at least when we did our research, there was a wonderful south swell. And so we surfed Waikiki and we surfed all the breaks on the south shore. Some of these require a lot of paddling to get out to. They're all known breaks and so on. Then if you go in the winter, we've already had one swell already on the north shore, but that's when you're going to get these spectacularly big waves in places like Waimea or in Ehukai Beach Park or Sunset Point, which are really the beginnings of some of the finest professional competitions. You can kind of trace professional surfing by moving around the island of Hawaii. You could look at Waikiki, or you go to Makaha, and then you go further around to the north shore. And so this is kind of the emergence of Hawaii is so critical because of its exposure to these wonderful swells and the challenge of those breaks, and also the accessibility. If you want to take a picture of somebody riding a very hollow wave, the lighting at a place like Pipeline is absolutely perfect, and you can sit on the sand and feel the water just shake it as it's in front of you. And so Hawaii is it's the birthplace, the showplace for surfing. And that a lot of that lies in its exposure.
And the exposure, almost by definition, any people that can reach the Hawaiian Islands, it's one of the most isolated places on the planet. So any people that can populate the Hawaiian Islands and settle them, by definition, have to be able to cross thousands of miles of open ocean. So you have to be unbelievably tuned in to the oceanic environment just to reach the Hawaiian Islands. So the Polynesian settlers who got there, it's almost like a self-selecting group of people who have to be amazing water people, who have to be in tune with the ocean and be amazing sailors and also expert swimmers. So the people who first settled the Hawaiian Islands were, by definition, you know, amazing water people. And they expressed that then in the subsequent centuries in their culture. And they built a culture around surfing. The religion was tied into surfing politics. The chiefs expressed a lot of their power through surfing. Gender roles, women surfed as much as men did. So they really built their entire culture around surfing. And this is because they were a water people.
You conclude your section on Hawaii, though, by saying that at the time of the island's annexation to the United States, so in the late 1800s, surfing was really dying by that point. So why was that the case, and what brought about the revival of surfing in the early 1900s?
You know, one of the things we try to do throughout the book is, you know, as historians always try to say, why did this happen at this particular place and time? So for early Hawaii, before the arrival of Captain Cook, why did surfing thrive so much? And it was especially, you know, the geography encouraged it, the culture encouraged it, the physical lifestyles of the people encouraged it, especially the leisure time encouraged it. What happened after the arrival of Cook and the Westerners, there were a series of events. A lot of people have focused on the arrival of the missionaries, and they say that the missionaries arrived around 1820, a few decades after Captain Cook, and they quickly stamped out surfing because they thought it was this heathen activity that did not comport with Western religion. We looked at that in quite a bit of detail and decided that's basically kind of a myth, the idea that missionaries stamped out surfing because they thought it was heathen activity. Actually, a lot of the missionaries thought that surfing was a healthy outdoor sport and that it was something to be emulated and not stamped out. We look at several other factors. One is the transformation of the Hawaiian economy from this fish farming and these amazing supplies of food and stuff. Instead of having all this leisure time to go fish, Hawaiians were enlisted in the sandalwood and the whaling and the sugar industries, and they just didn't have time to surf anymore. But the main reason was, well, a secondary reason is the environment. And throughout the book, we really look at the effects of the environment and environmental pollution. By the mid-19th century, people were calling Honolulu Harbor the cesspool of the Pacific. Probably the main reason, no doubt the main reason, is the demographic collapse of the Hawaiian people because of the introduction of Western diseases with the arrival of Captain Cook. And because the Hawaiian Islands were so isolated, they'd had no exposure to any of these diseases when Captain Cook arrived. So they had no antibodies build up, and they were just unbelievably susceptible, and they just dropped once all these Western diseases, smallpox, typhus, venereal disease, and the rest. They just decimated the Hawaiian people. It was an unbelievable, almost unprecedented demographic collapse. So it wasn't that the Hawaiians stopped surfing because they didn't like it or because the Westerners didn't like it. It was because there were no Hawaiians almost left alive to ride waves. There were so few Hawaiians left that it looked like surfing had died out when it was just the fact that the Hawaiian people were dying out.
So who is it then that brings the revival of surfing then in Hawaii in the early 1900s?
Well, the revival comes from two factors. One is led by native Hawaiians themselves. There's a few Hawaiians who were left alive after this unbelievable demographic collapse. And they are desperately clinging to their native culture. And there's a few in particular who are still riding Waikiki around the turn of the century, around 1900. One gentleman named George Freeth does a lot to popularize or repopularize surfing off of Waikiki. So part of it is from native Hawaiians kind of clinging to or trying to revive some of their native culture. And then the other strand is from these new arrivals, what they call haoles in Hawaii, which are basically white settlers. And one of the things that occurs around the turn of the century is these Hawaiian elites turn to the tourist economy to replace the sugar economy. The sugar economy kind of faltered in the 1890s, so they're looking for a real replacement, a new business model, so to speak. And they seize on tourism. And this is part of, and Peter Neutral can go into more detail about this, but they actually said about, you know, Waikiki around 1900 was no tourist paradise because it was basically a wetland. And you can't build hotels in a wetland. So they had to actually engineer Waikiki to promote the tourism industry. But once they had Waikiki engineered, then they seized on surfing as the centerpiece of the Hawaiian beach lifestyle and used it to promote this new tourist industry. So that also then contributed to the revival of surfing in the early 20th century.
Yeah, if you were to pull up a Google Earth image of Waikiki today, you can still see where the streams once went through the reef. You can actually see evidence of that now. But Waikiki is a completely engineered environment. At one point, they brought sand from the U.S. to replenish Waikiki. Just recently, they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to make Waikiki wider. So it's a calculated, and we cover this throughout the book, it is a constructed environment. Now, the one thing that remains, I believe, natural about it are the waves.
And so in the engineering, this is something I'm interested in the engineering of Waikiki, there was always an attempt to maintain the waves, correct?
I think there's so many waves at Waikiki that there are certainly times when they blew up the reef, up parts of the reef, and, you know, to use it to build up base for hotels or to, you know, help create more concrete for a shopping center and whatnot. But I don't think that they've managed to change the waves that much. Although there are places like Magic Island, there are definitely waves. I'm not going to say they didn't eliminate waves. There are waves eliminated along Waikiki.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, though, about in the process of eliminating waves, sometimes you create waves. And so we cover that, not just on Oahu, but look at it elsewhere. Engineers and coastal engineering quite often can make waves at the same time as taking waves away. But in Waikiki, the chief concern of the people building hotels is you can't have your hotel undermined. So you have to keep some sort of shore protection. You have to keep either boulders, seawalls, groins, and especially sand as a buffer between you and the next big swell, because you can't have the Pink Hotel being undermined and falling into the water. And you need enough sand so people can lie on the beach, and you need enough sand so that someone can rent a surfboard and take a lesson. And so maintaining the beach for people concerned with tourism is absolutely priority one. And that's not just in Hawaii, that's worldwide.
Yeah, and one of the reasons we subtitled the book An Unconventional History of Surfing is we try to bring in some of these new angles like this. Again, this is something that people probably don't associate with surfing, is coastal engineering or engineering in general. But we really try to say that, look, if you're talking about the history of surfing in Hawaii, you know, everybody or a lot of people know the name of Duke Hanamoku. He's probably the most famous surfer of all time and one of the most phenomenal athletes of the 20th century. We like to say that he was Kelly Slater and Michael Phelps rolled into one. He was a phenomenal, you know, world-class, multiple Olympic gold medalist in swimming and also the best surfer by far of his generation. So people associate surfing, the history of surfing, with Duke Hanamoku. And we have to spend a lot of time talking about Duke because he is crucial to the history of surfing. But then we also talk about people like the Dillingham family. And the Dillingham family is this humongous engineering conglomerate, construction conglomerate in the Hawaiian Islands that has really been fundamental in reshaping the landscape, including the coastal landscape of the Hawaiian Islands. And you could argue that Dillingham is important to surfing in Hawaii, somebody like Duke, just in their effect on the physical environment. So we try to bring in some of these new angles on the history of surfing through people like Dillingham, who don't normally show up in history of surfing, but we think are absolutely vital if you're looking at the history of this sport over the last 100, 150 years.
Yeah, that was something I really enjoyed about the book. And late in the book, in one of the later chapters, you have this line about how surfers themselves haven't really paid attention to the engineering, because typically a surfer is sitting or lying on his board, paddling out, looking outward instead of looking in to see what has changed on the coastline. And you mentioned also later in your book that the Corps of Engineers, the United States Corps of Engineers, which handles these major engineering projects in the United States, has probably had a greater influence on surfing than any surfer or any company or any other institution.
Yeah, the Corps is one of the oldest entities in the United States, and one of their responsibilities is and always has been shore protection. You know, if you're in your town, say you're in Santa Barbara, and you go down to the breakwater there, that is a breakwater that was, in fact, not built by the Army Corps of Engineers. They produced a design which the local community didn't like. It wasn't in the place that they wanted it, and it wasn't pretty. And so the Fleischmann Margarine family put in this breakwater that goes parallel to the coast here in Santa Barbara. And the result is that it cuts off sand, or that the sand, there's not enough, it wasn't designed so that sand would bypass the down coast beaches. And so essentially a new harbor was forming in some of the most expensive real estate in the world because there was no more sand going past the harbor. And so today, when you arrive at the harbor, there will be a Army Corps of Engineers dredge there that is providing artificial sand bypass. In other words, it's pumping the sand that's building up behind this visually pleasing breakwater that is dysfunctional so that Montecito doesn't become a bay down coast from Santa Barbara Harbor. And so that's sort of an example here, as I'm sitting here, of how the Army Corps affects the marine environment and affects our coastline. In fact, all of the flood control for Santa Barbara County was done by the Army Corps of Engineers. So whenever we have a major rainfall, all of the channels, all of the runoff, that's all part of a master plan that is supposed to get the water away from our communities and keep from flooding our communities and out into the ocean. So this is has been part of this agency's or this group's mission for hundreds of years. And so it's something, though, that people have absolutely no idea what the Army Corps of Engineers is. They have absolutely no idea, that they essentially made Newport Beach or that they created all these harbors. Because here in California, every time you make a harbor, it cuts off down coast sand flow. And so you then have to engineer means for building up the down coast beach. Or, you know, each time you do something to the coast, it has an impact down coast or up coast that will affect some very expensive real estate. And that then requires protection. And so the Corps works with local communities to wrestle with these problems anywhere. But New Orleans, for example, we all know the story of New Orleans. It's essentially, you can stay at a downtown hotel in New Orleans and about 20 feet above your head is the Mississippi River. it's really bizarre. It's an artificial environment.
Again, this kind of goes back to some of these contradictions we see in the image of surfing. You know, most people think of surfing as it's this natural sport. You're out there communing with nature. You're literally immersed in the oceanic environment. And you're out there and there's dolphins and pelicans and you're watching the sunset. And it's this communion with nature is how a lot of people portray it. But in reality, when you think about it, you know, they are part of this amazingly engineered landscape. And a lot of the landscape is, in fact, artificial. A lot of that engineering is to allow all these millions of people to live near the coast. You know, the human populations are concentrating more and more along coastlines. But in order to have all these people living along coastlines, a lot of that requires human intervention with the environment and engineering, flood control, harbors, and the rest of it. So we really try to bring out some of these tensions between these images of surfing as this natural pursuit versus all this engineering and technology and artifice that enables them to pursue this sport.
And a lot of the water, which you write about, is full of human waste.
Oh, yeah. This is another one of the less appealing aspects of surfing that we try to bring at least to people's attention. Because, again, when you have millions of people concentrating along coastlines, all those millions of people produce a lot of trash and sewage, and all that stuff has to go somewhere. And along coastlines, that stuff goes out of the oceans. And surfers are literally soaking at the boundary or the interface between civilization and the natural environment. But because they're at that interface, they are the ones most immediately impacted by all of this sewage burden and the pollution that comes with human society, modern society.
So it's amazing. You ask students in a course, what happens when you flush the toilet? They have no idea. It just goes someplace where it's not in my house anymore. Well, surfers are sort of at the cutting edge of that, and it's a little bit disconcerting, but I think it's important because there are so many surfers that we have awareness of these are the basics. You need to be aware of the basics, and then I think when the town decides whether or not they want to have secondary or tertiary treatment of sewage, you have more information at hand as to why you might want that to happen.
And some of the biggest surfing populations in the world are in places like New York, Los Angeles, San Diego, Sydney, Australia, where you basically would not be able to surf if there hadn't been the development of sewage treatment systems over the last century. Or you can turn that around and say that actually it was the importance of coastal recreation to places like Los Angeles and San Diego and Orange County and Sydney, Australia, that really drove the development of sewage treatment systems. Because even back in the 1930s, they were complaining about beach closures because of sewage at places like Long Beach. The LA River outflows at Long Beach, and they were having to close down the beach in the 1930s because there was so much sewage in the water that the LA River was just carrying down. The LA River was basically the sewage disposal system for LA. And the importance of coastal recreation and real estate really drove the demand that, you know, clean up this ocean environment because we want to be able to swim the ocean out here. And surfers wouldn't be able to surf today if that movement hadn't gained some traction and led to the development, or in Honolulu for the same reason. They started realizing 50 years ago that, look, Waikiki is based on people coming to the beach and playing in the water. And we have these sewage outfalls at either end of Waikiki Beach. And if we don't do something about this sewage, we're going to lose the cash cow that is the Waikiki tourist industry, because people aren't going to pay thousands of dollars to come to Waikiki and watch big rafts of sewage wafting by at Waikiki.
Peter Westwick, you mentioned earlier one of the most important, probably the most important surfer of the 20th century, Duke Kahanamoku. And so I'll ask you to explain why is he such a significant figure? In fact, he plays throughout your book.
Yeah, he was really crucial in the revival in the early 20th century in kind of popularizing surfing and became really the public face of surfing. And this brings up another great issue that we haven't really talked about yet, but one of the reasons for the revival of surfing in the early 20th century, and that is swimming. We're on a sports website, and surfing has been very intimately involved or tied into swimming from its inception for the very basic reason that you can't surf if you can't swim. And one of the reasons why surfing could catch on around 1900 is because people could swim. So we go in and we look at the development of swimming over the course of the 1800s. And the construction of public swimming pools and swim lessons available through things like the YMCA, and basically teaching the American public how to swim so that when they go on vacation to Hawaii, then they can go out and surf and take a surfboard out and not drown. So that's one of the reasons swimming was important to surfing. The other reason is that a lot of the really early popularizers, people like Duke Kahanamoku, were competitive swimmers. First and foremost, and served for a secondary. So Duke was an amazing world-class swimmer, and that's how he came to public attention, was setting world records as this unknown teenager out of Hawaii who started setting world records and then winning Olympic gold medals and then going on these swimming exhibitions around the world. And when he'd go on these exhibitions, oftentimes, say, in Sydney, Australia, he was there for a swimming tour. He gave a swimming exhibition, and then in between swimming tours, went out, carved a board out of the tree down there, sugar pine, and went out and surfed, and basically planted surfing in Australia. So swimming was really crucial to the development of surfing. And then over the course of the 20th century, more Americans learned how to swim, more pools were built, and the Great Depression, the federal government is building urban swimming pools. So more and more people learn how to swim, and more people then can surf.
Yeah, I think a lot of, for example, if you were to ask the Duke, if we had the Duke with us today and said, what is the defining moment in your career, in your life? And I think he would say winning a gold medal in Antwerp in 1920. He was the fastest human being in the world in the water. People in Australia were there. They came out. Thousands of people would come out to watch the Duke swim. I mean, this is essential. This is Michael Phelps. Okay. Now, yes, surfing is a big part of his life as well. But he went to great lengths to retain his amateur status. And there was money on the table that he left because he wished to remain an amateur. And as we know, early in the Olympic history, you could not take money. If you jeopardized your amateur status, you would never swim in the Olympics again. There was a lot. When you talk about Duke, there's a lot about swimming there. The Huinalu Club, the Club of the Waves, was a swim club. It was created for him to swim. He swam all over the world. And so a big part of the history of surfing is connected, and it has to be, to the history of swimming. And that definitely comes out in our book.
Well, let's jump ahead a few decades. And I want to talk about surfing in California in the 60s and 70s. And you talk about post-war California and how surfing was such an integral part of the social and cultural history of the Southern California boom in the post-war period. You talk about surfing films, you talk about the Beach Boys and surfing music, but you devote more attention to surfing and counterculture, particularly surfing and drugs in the 1960s and into the 1970s. So can you talk about surfing and the counterculture, the youth culture in the 60s?
Yeah, I mean, this again is one of these tensions in the image of surfing. If you look at surfing as it's presented, say, in Gidget or in Beach Blanket Bingo, you know, with Frankie and Annette on the beach in Malibu, or the Beach Boys, you know, they're out there in their, you know, button-down shirts. It's this very kind of clean, home, healthy image, very middle-class, mainstream image of surfing as this, you know, healthy outdoor sport. In fact, that's, I think, a direct quote from Gidget. When she comes home and tells her dad that she wants to take up surfing, he says, "Oh, I don't mind. My daughter enjoys the pleasures of a nice outdoor sport." So there's this kind of middle-class image of surfing in the 50s and 60s. This kind of father's knows best very much aligns with that. But then there's this counter image of surfing as this, you know, kind of rebellious, subversive, outlawed counterculture. You know, it's just a bunch of bums down on the beach drinking beer and blowing off work and going out to catch some waves. And the Kahuna, you know, the Gidget is a great movie for this because it really shows off these two competing images. You have the Moondoggy, who's the clean-cut frat boy, and then you have Kahuna, who's living on a shack at Malibu without a job, just a total surf bum. So what happens in the 60s is the kind of surf bum counterculture image kind of takes precedence or finally passes the kind of clean, wholesome image of surfing. So surfing now becomes this subversive, rebellious counterculture, and that becomes the main identity of surfing. And one of the reasons that happens is the association with drugs in the 60s. And it's not just that surfers were taking drugs, but they actually, if you look into the story, there's a really fascinating story here about how surfers almost, not single-handedly, but made crucial contributions to the drug culture itself and the drug trade. This network of Laguna Beach surfers, they started smuggling drugs. They were off on these surf trips to places like Baja, Mexico, and then later on to Southeast Asia. And they realized that these places they were visiting were great sources of drugs. First, marijuana and hash. Later on, some harder drugs. But then they also realized that surfboards provided excellent smuggling tools. They started making hollow surfboards, filling up these hollow boards with drugs, and then, you know, driving back over the border with these hollow surfboards. They'd get back to Laguna Beach, cut the boards open, start pulling out the bags of pot or hash, and then they'd sell that and make a fortune. And pretty soon they did have a smuggling ring worth about $250 million. And the feds pretty quickly realized that this was the biggest smuggling ring in the United States, as they put it, in the history of organized drug smuggling. And one of the reasons it took the feds so long to catch on was because they could not believe that these surfers had their act together enough to actually pull off something as complicated as they did this $250 million smuggling ring, which basically by the late 60s, early 70s had global reach. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Morocco, Southeast Asia, Central America, basically around the world. And these surfers were sitting at the center of it. So this group of Laguna Beach surfers really almost enabled the entire 60s drug culture by creating this huge network that was originally based on their surf travels.
Yeah, we started off talking about localism and how that's almost always evident in surf films. well, thematically, especially recently, you know, drugs are always evident. There's some drugs are connected to surfing in some way or another. And we trace that, I think, looking in the 60s chapter, but that, sadly, that continues to be a problem today.
Yeah.
I mean, there are not too many professional sports where there could be a drug-related problem with a world champion. And that does happen, but that's an issue with surfing.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the early 1970s, two of the best surfers in the world, the ones who were winning the most contests, Michael Peterson and Jeff Heckman, were heroin addicts. And as we say in the book, try to think of another major sport, where probably the two top competitors are smack addicts. And it really kind of boggles the mind. But in surfing, it not only happens and continues to happen, but it's almost part of the surfing culture. It's so accepted that this is almost seen as part of surfing's countercultural credibility in some respects. Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, we're almost out of time, and I want to ask, we've been talking about surfing in California, we've been talking about surfing in Hawaii, and to close, though, I want to ask about surfing in Australia. You do devote a good part of a chapter to surfing in Australia, and you talk about how different the picture of the surfer in Australian culture is from the picture of the surfer in Californian culture. So can you talk about the image of the surfer in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, the surf culture in Australia is a bit different from Southern California in that it derives a lot from the lifeguarding culture and life-saving culture. And the whole life-saving movement in Australia goes back, over a century to the kind of Victorian period and this idea of, well, first of all, preventing people from drowning on the beach, of course, is the first first goal of life-saving. But the whole movement in Australia became this thing of, first of all, you're kind of disciplining the environment, you're taming the ocean, you're preventing people from drowning in the ocean, you're making the ocean safe for people to swim in. But it became this kind of ultra-competitive, almost militaristic culture of life-saving, where they have these contests, and each club has their uniform, and they have their flags and banners, and they have this thing called the March Past, where at the start of every competition on the weekends, each club marches down the beach in formation with their uniforms on and their flags, and it's this very kind of quasi-militaristic display of lifeguard culture. And in surfing in Australia, surfing kind of came out of that culture where they started forming surf clubs and having surf contests. So it's very much more competitive, very much more organized, kind of rigorous approach to surfing, as opposed to the California, the California culture kind of derived a lot from Hawaii. In fact, they called themselves the Coast Howlies. And it was, we're going to build a shack on the beach and we're going to weave palm frond hats and we're going to sit there and we're going to strum our ukuleles on the beach at San Onofre before we paddle out. Whereas in Australia, it's we're going to have a surf contest and we're going to have, team uniforms and we're going to, grade the contest and score them and then total it up. And you have this very cutthroat competitive system that develops by the, late 60s, into the 1960s and into the 1970s in Australia. This very kind of competitive environment for surfing. And that then contributes to the growth of pro surfing and the popularity of pro surfing in Australia. But the surfer in Australia really becomes tied in with the whole national identity. As more of the Australian population moves to the coast, to places like Sydney, if you think 100 years ago what people thought of Australia, they thought of the Bushmen. It's Waltzing Matilda and this guy out there in the bush, out in the outback. Whereas now I think the main public image for Australia is a surfer on the beach. So there's been this transformation over the last 100 years, but it's a very different kind of culture and image than you have, at least when this first emerged in the 60s and 70s, from this kind of countercultural image in California of surf culture. And in Australia, it was this kind of, rigorous, very competitive sport. And much more of a sport than, say, the lifestyle. In California, surfers tend to think of surfing as either an art or a lifestyle, but not necessarily a sport. It's something to be judged and something to be competed at. Whereas in Australia, from this period, surfing was a sport, and we're going to compete And we're going to have contests, and we're going to judge the contests and score them, and individual competition, club competition, team competition. It was very much a sport, professional sport, from the outset.
I would add that Australia has had a major contribution from an industry perspective in order to feed this culture of surfing that emerged so quickly. And a part of that, of course, is they have an amazing swim culture there as well. But companies like Quiksilver, Billabong, et cetera, have emerged and become enormously powerful and influential worldwide because of the sort of what Peter Westbrook defined there as a very well-defined surf culture.
Peter, and Peter, to finish up, Peter Neuschel, you mentioned earlier your research, and I have my scare quotes up, your research in going to Hawaii and surfing on Waikiki. So I want to ask about this project in which you were able to research by surfing. So how many places did you visit in the course of researching this book to try your hand at surfing these different areas?
I've been going to Hawaii my whole life, but we did visit, you know, we went out to use the Bishop Museum and do this research on sport in Hawaii, and we had a really nice south swell there, surfed around Waikiki and elsewhere around the island. And it was just a wonderful experience. We did that together. We had been to Hawaii independently, of course. I went to Australia and did some research there, and visited Maroubra, I joined the Surf Life Saving Club there. Anybody can do it right there on the beach. So, and I'd been to Africa. I'd been, you know, in the course of our lives surfing, we've been all over the world already. But we did do some field research, and I think that was important to do. And there are museums, surfing museums around the world that we've looked at, and libraries. And I think that gave some depth to the book. We did a number of oral histories that I think were important. And we took the tools of the historian, we took the historical method and kind of applied it to this. And I think there is a lot of new information in this book that you're not going to see in other surf histories. And that part of that is because of the field work that we did.
Yeah. And we visited some of the places like Caltech, the Caltech archives. And Peter and I both spent quite a bit of time in the Caltech archives for other projects. So we went there and we actually found a lot of really interesting and crucial stuff on the contributions of military R&D, military research and development during World War II to surfing technology in World War II through Caltech. But one of the great things about this book and one of the fun things was not only doing research that we're used to in places like Caltech, but then to go, you know, most of my history of science research does not usually take me to Hawaii, unfortunately, but this was a great excuse to go over there, actually find some great stuff in the Bishop Museum archives and doing oral histories over there. But, you know, before and after in the mornings and then in the evenings going out and surfing. And I think that was also, you know, that was not just goofing around or for fun. I mean, that experience really informed the book. I mean, we closed the book with this little vignette of going out. You know, we'd been in the archives that day, and then we go out at evening. The south swell was still running. The sun was setting, and we paddle out at Waikiki. And you start to realize, like, why Waikiki was and remains the cradle of surfing and the epicenter of surfing, because it really is a magical spot. And it gets you back to why the ancient Hawaiians took up this sport 500 years ago and why surfing is so popular today, because you paddle out at Waikiki today, just as the Hawaiians did 500 years ago, and the water's warm and the sun is setting and Diamond Head is kind of over your shoulder. And it's just a magical spot. The waves are great, and you're sitting there out there catching waves and surfing into the beach while the sun is setting, and it's really a magical experience. And it kind of gets you back to this is what it's all about. So you can do all the archival research and all that stuff, and that's important to do as historians. But it's also important to keep in mind, you know, why people do this sport in the first place. And being there on Waikiki and having that experience was a great reminder of that.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Westwick and Peter Neuschel about their book, The World in the Curl, An Unconventional History of Surfing, published by Crown in 2013. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications,
on subjects from religion to Russian studies. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.